As Joseph first becomes the focus of the Genesis account, we find what you have here is a map of kind of helping us pinpoint where some of the important events of these chapters are happening. So, numbered conveniently from 1 to 6, hope you can see the numbers, but circle number 1, Jacob and his sons settle in the valley of Hebron, and so that's chapter 37 where Joseph has a couple of dreams, actually relates those to his brothers, and one of those his father rebukes him. Then in the pivotal chapter, the pivotal text where Joseph is sold into slavery, he first thinks that he will catch up with his brothers. He is sent there by Jacob to Shechem, and that's where number 2 is located. He finds out, though, the brothers are no longer there. They've gone to Dothan, so even further north, even to the west, there would be Dothan. Of course, Egypt is down here to the far west, the far southwest, and that's where everybody's going to end up going. That's where the Ishmaelite traders take Joseph. They sell him to Potiphar in Egypt. I'm not sure if we're told how much he was sold for in Egypt, but I assume it was at a profit. So whatever, 20 shekels minus the purchase price. I would imagine they tried to make some sort of profit, or maybe just broke even. I don't know. But Joseph's brothers in this text will travel in chapter 42 to and from Egypt for food because of a famine, chapters 42 through 44 in point of fact. And then soon, Jacob will learn that Joseph is alive and will move with his entire family to Egypt, and they'll settle in the land of Goshen. Let's begin by just hitting the highlights of the key events of this text. As chapter 42 begins, of course, there is famine in the land of Canaan. Joseph commissions 10 of his sons, who, of course, all of which are brothers to Joseph. He sends the brothers to Egypt to get grain. This is the first of many instances of God's, the demonstration of God's sovereignty. God here is using the weather, he is using a famine for the purpose ultimately of bringing the Messiah into the world. This is just one little piece of the puzzle, but he's going to get Jacob's family eventually down to Egypt. Jacob and his family. Well, this is just episode 1 in this. There's going to be a lot of back and forth, but this is how contact is first established. The first step toward an important reconciliation, not just for the family of Jacob, but for all of us. And well, make no mistake, God is using this for our good. And so Jacob sends 10 sons to Egypt. Of course, he keeps Benjamin home. Who could blame him? I don't know if you would be willing to go so far as to say, this is just a Bible study thought, that this demonstrates probably some lingering distrust on the part of Jacob to not trust these brothers ever again was something so important to him. When he sent the other son of Rachel out to find them, in his mind, it resulted in Joseph's death. Of course, he'll soon learn that that's not the case. But, I mean, in effect, Joseph has been dead. Jacob has been grieving as if he's been dead. He's been living with the pain of thinking that he's dead. And that pain is very, very real, as if Joseph had, in fact, died, because that's all that Jacob believes. So Jacob keeps Benjamin home, fearing that he will lose him also. Well, when they get to Egypt, there is this certainly not just a coincidental meeting between Joseph and the 10 brothers. The text says in chapter 42 and verse 6 that Joseph, depending upon the translation, was ruler of the land of Egypt. He was governor. The English Standard Version says he was in charge of the country, and as such, in charge of selling grain. So this authority that Pharaoh has given to Joseph continues. Joseph has been a very effective administrator because the good hand of God has been upon him. The land has gone through the 7 years of plenty. Joseph has led the people in capitalizing on that prosperity and setting aside and saving for what was coming. And in fact, as a function of how well Joseph has done that, not only have the people of Egypt prospered, but now they've become a source of salvation for places elsewhere, including the land of Canaan. And so people from everywhere are coming to Egypt to buy grain. And so in verses 6 through 9, we see a very important moment in the Genesis story. Verse 7 says, "When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them." We're going to talk about why that was. I want you, in fact, to be thinking ahead about. I think I asked you in the study guide, what would you have done if you were Joseph? We're going to pivot from that. That's an interesting question. But the fact is, we need to now just, what Joseph did was wise. And we need to understand why it was wise that he dealt with his brothers in this way. There are several things that we're going to try to draw out from one another about that. So I've essentially told you what the discussion question will be. But he recognizes... he recognizes more than his brothers. Verse 9, what else does he recognize in 42:9? Okay, he remembers the dreams. I conclude that it's at this moment where he has his, oh, this is why all this has happened. And so then all the more reason, well, we'll get to the why it was so wise for Joseph to handle this the way that he did. Joseph here recognizes, certainly this is a big moment where there's a step forward in his recognition of the hand of God in all of this. Now, his to just kind of put out there how he chooses to deal with them, he deals with them, as the brothers will say later, very roughly. In the manual of how to win friends and influence people, probably step one is not to accuse your guests of being spies to come in and survey to find out the weaknesses of the land of Egypt. But that's precisely what Joseph accuses these brothers of. Now, that forces them to give an accounting of themselves. And in that, Joseph effectively draws out what are some commendable traits on the part of the brothers. And I would posit he sees some growth in them. But there are these exchanges. There are various tests that Joseph administers, if you will, for lack of a better word, and I'm sure there is a better word there. But he offers, he wants to see Benjamin. That becomes very clear as he inquires, as the brothers reflect later. It's like, wow, he was very pointed in his questions, and we kind of felt like we had to answer, but he's asking, do you have another brother? And he, in fact, learns there are 12 and there is one other. And just seems strangely to show so much interest in seeing that brother. And so at first, I'll send one of you back to get him. The rest of you have to stay here. And then 3 days later, he revises that offer and says, just leave one of your brothers here. And that's enough of a figure if I at least keep one around that y'all like. Then you'll probably come back to get him. You don't want to lose another brother. So there's all of that back and forth as the brothers have their first audience with Joseph. And then, as I've just mentioned, I'm just calling this the first and second audience that they have with him. So in the later part of chapter 42, they report to Jacob and give an accurate and full accounting of what has happened. Of course, on the way home, there's a very startling discovery that one of them makes in his sack. What does he find? He finds the money that that he took with him. And when you read the text, that one discovery alone was enough to really cause them, oh boy, we're going to have trouble here. Well, when they get home, they all discover that there's money in their sacks. And so now the sons and Jacob are all very, very afraid. And Jacob, of course, this just all amplifies his grief. Simeon's in Egypt. Benjamin now is at risk. He's already in his mind lost Joseph. And so he's like, I'm just losing my sons here one at a time. Reuben makes an interesting offer. He offers to allow his two sons to be killed if he doesn't bring Benjamin back. Clearly, Reuben is still not trusted. But time passes, and I don't know exactly how much, except to say that by the time we get to chapter 43, verse 1 says the famine was severe, and verse 2 says they've exhausted their supply of the grain that they had purchased, quote unquote, the first time. And so now their hand has been forced. They're kind of, I don't know if they've been wringing their hands. It kind of seems like maybe they've been wringing their hands, or what are we going to do? Well, now their hand's kind of forced. They've run out of grain. They have to go back. And so the brothers return. Jacob relents and seems to arrive at some peace about it, that if I lose another son, I lose another son. We have to survive. And Judah really shows his quality here. Of course, he is willing to bear the blame forever. And so Judah is able to persuade Jacob to send Benjamin. He sends, in fact, many things: fruit, produce, gifts, double the money, of course, what they took the first time, plus the second purchase. And then, of course, the brother Benjamin, entrusting himself, chapter 43 and verse 14, if you'll read with me, it says, "And may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man," referring to Joseph, "so that he will release to you your other brother, Simeon, and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So the brothers return back to Egypt with Benjamin. Of course, Joseph is still testing his brothers. When he first sees Benjamin from afar, presumably it's from afar, he prepares this great feast for them, shows hospitality to them in washing their feet, feeding their animals, and then begins to inquire about their father and his welfare, sees Benjamin and becomes very, very emotional, for not the first or the last time he's been emotional. So much so, he has to retire and wash his face, and then orders the serving of food. One of the interesting things about the dinner that they have is, tell me about the seating order, the seating arrangements at this dinner. What are the brothers surprised to discover? Yeah, the birth order. He's like, I mean, I'm too tired to try to do the math, but some of you that are sharp at statistics could probably, what would the statistical odds be of randomly guessing? You know, that's worse than the lottery, isn't it? That's getting 12 numbers in the right sequence. Just picking the right 12 numbers, well, it's just 1 through 12, but getting them in the right order, the brothers in the right order. It's like, okay, I mean, at that point, the possibilities that either this is a man who has supernatural ability, has the ability of, to pick Joseph's words, of divination, to divine somehow. He has some degree of clairvoyance to be able to see and know things that no mortal could know. Or they're not allowing into their minds the possibility that there could be another reason why he knows the birth order. So he's keeping them quite off balance, I think. But Benjamin receives five times the portion as the others. Then that brings us to chapter 44. And again, they return, or they start to return. But this time, one little adjustment, it's really one big adjustment, to this time it's not just money in the sacks. What else does Joseph order be done? To be placed in a particular sack. The silver cup goes in whose sack? Benjamin. Goes in the cup of Benjamin. And I don't know how far he lets them go, but he sends forces after them, brings them back, and then begins to deal very harshly with them. And chapter 44 and verse 14, Judah and his brothers react in a very humble way before Joseph. They fall to the ground, verse 14 says, before him. Joseph is asking them to give an account for this. And Judah here again shows his quality. How can we justify ourselves? By the way, that is a gospel question, isn't it? And it's a bit rhetorical. The answer is none of us could ever justify ourselves. What could we say? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. And that's exactly right. God long ago had found out the iniquity of these brothers, as he does for any of us. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found. Joseph, though, is saying, nope, it's going to be the one that took it. And then Judah intercedes, verse 18, and says, oh, my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears. And then begins to appeal on behalf of the father and begins to talk about Jacob and the grief that he is suffering because of having lost one son already. And at that point, I mean, Judah's explanation runs down really through the end of chapter 44. And in verse 34 concludes the chapter when he says, for how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father? And of course, now Judah is mortified to think. Now, I want you to think about the alignment that has happened. The alignment in thinking between Joseph and the brothers. They're all of one mind and one heart about, let's not cause Jacob any more grief. And it's at that moment, chapter 45, Joseph can't stand it anymore. And all of this is brought to a very happy resolution as Joseph then reveals himself to his brothers, speaks kindly to them, weeps over them, kisses each of them. It is a scene, perhaps it's such an awesome scene, excelled perhaps only by the reunion that's coming between Joseph and Jacob. A wonderful scene, a wonderful picture that we see here at the end of chapter 45. And then, of course, Pharaoh hears about all of this and is quite pleased and provides whatever resources are needed and then some to aid in the relocation of Jacob and his family to Egypt, which is what God has been working toward all along. And in his own good time has brought it about. And soon, not just Joseph, but all the brothers will come to see that. And that will be important to the tribes, important to their willingness to rehearse the promises to each generation through all of those years of slavery until God sends a deliverer named Moses. Okay, now, We tried this last week with less technical advantage. Tonight surely should be better. I want you to discuss this question with each other tonight, just there in your seats. Again, don't hurt yourself trying to turn around, okay? Last week it sounded much like I hoped it would, basically the time before our worship begins, and we act like we're very glad to see one another. I just want you to kick this around. I'm going to give you an extra minute this time. So 4 minutes, I'm going to try to get out among you a little bit more. Why was it so wise for Joseph to deal with his brothers in the way that he did? And I have in mind there, you know, his basically hiding his identity, to dealing with them roughly, to testing them, to asking them questions about their family, and even including his conversation with them after revealing himself. All of those things on multiple levels, I think, show a wisdom on the part of Joseph. It is the wisdom of God in accomplishing reconciliation that I think is worth thinking about. So I'm going to give you 4 minutes. If you want to move around and talk about this with somebody you're not seated beside, so be it. But go ahead. Hopefully this thing will start. It hasn't yet. Ah! I set that for automatic playback. Yeah, click it. Click it. There we go. It's not doing it. I'll start one anyway. Oh, well. It's going now. Okay. I forgot to turn my mic off. I did so for your sakes. Okay, one of the things, I'll just get us started. One of the things that I heard from several groups that I was just kind of meandering around was this Joseph wanting to see where his brothers were at, where their thinking was at. Are they remorseful at all? Have they changed at all? Raise your hand if any of you guys talked about that. I want to say that was a big one on my list, okay? All right, I think there's a lot to that. By the way, let me just stick with that for a second. Why would his disguising his identity be useful to determining whether they really have changed? If he wants to know whether they're genuinely... Okay, somebody get Daniel a mic back there. Weigh in on this.
So I think there are a couple of things that we talked about. But when someone, like when the brothers know it's Joseph, then how can Joseph trust what they're saying? Because if he's the ruler of the land, he has complete power over them. And so they're just going to say whatever they think he wants to hear. But when Joseph figures out who they are without them knowing it's him, then
right,
he can trust that their character is like actually as they presented it. It's also nice for the brothers that, you know, when Judah offered his life for Joseph's, he knows that Joseph knows it was genuine. And
yeah.
So the brothers actually know that they've demonstrated that they've changed. And so it's easier for them as well.
You just take any perceived bias out of it, right? Yeah, I mean, he knows they, the last face-to-face they had didn't go too well for him. They did not like him at all. And so, assuming that that's still there, let's just take that out, and then I want to see what's in their hearts. So that wouldn't muddy the waters at all. That's a good thought. Anybody else have a thought of why was it so wise for Joseph to disguise his identity? Almost there. Thank you, Jared.
Do you remember when Daniel was over the kingdom and they decided the guys to go after, the lower level decided to go after Daniel? Well, there were politics in Egypt at this time, and I think that Joseph had to do this because they were presented as spies to him. And if he didn't show this, he is the number one ruler besides one guy.
Right.
If he doesn't show this spy routine and take it to the ultimate decision, then the rest of the court would probably have rebelled against this non-Egyptian who is over all of us. Now, that's a completely separate train of thought than most people would run. And I read that. The only reason I came up with it, on a commentary that was presented that argument.
So, the thought being is that Joseph's advisors, his close advisors, were the ones positing the thought of possible spy activity. I'm not sure if I could prove that from the text, but that's interesting. It's a plausible explanation and good for this discussion, certainly. Yeah, there may certainly have been other factors. And then we need a mic up here. You two will probably just have to stay standing the whole time, I hate to say it. Go ahead.
I think the things that are before us to consider are confession and repentance. I think that Joseph understands something about being accountable to God. And I think his choices are that he knew it was in the best interest that they confess their ways in dealing with him, and that repentance was necessary for them if they were going to be
Yeah.
Kingdom. And I just think, I have thought for a long time that confession is something that we think is easy to do. But
not if we do it well.
When you put your own words that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, you live with that confession the rest of your life.
Yeah. And heaven hears it, and heaven will hold you to it. That's right. That's right. Let me piggyback off that thought. I think that's... Let me direct it this way. If Joseph indeed is now recognizing, as I believe he is, that when the text says he remembers the dreams, to me that's the cue in the text that Joseph is putting the pieces together. He knows who it is. He knows what he's dreamed. And if he hasn't reached the conclusion that God is... I mean, who was behind the dreams if God wasn't behind the dreams? Certainly he understands God is behind this. And so, I mean, with Potiphar's wife, this is how he's wired. Now this is how he's wired. And so what would be heaven's agenda for this, I mean, otherwise we would say strangely coincidental, I mean... what are the odds that these 11 would all end up, or 12 all end up in the same place at the same time? He understands God has done that. So let's continue. What then? What would God want the outcome to be? Reconciliation is the goal. There has to be a restoration of this relationship. Now, I want you to think about the angle of Joseph's emotions. How emotional is Joseph throughout all of this? We have any indication of his...
He cries at least three times it's recorded. He cries.
Joseph doesn't strike me, for all that he's gone through, for all the trauma he's endured. I mean, if you've ever undergone severe trauma, those tears can be triggered like that. I have relatives for whom this is the case.
It was so loud.
I mean, this is quite involuntary. He is very emotional. Question. Sometimes you ask a question, everybody already knows the answer. You ever find that emotion gets in the way of clear thinking? Especially when you're trying to resolve a conflict.
I want to say something about Joseph, though, and his love for the Lord. Because,
yeah. Here's the microphone.
Peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you this book.
Exactly right.
The steward could not have known that, except that that's who Joseph is. Joseph has been this character or person from the very beginning. When Manasseh and Ephraim are born, he says, God has given me. And he names his sons according to what he thinks God has given him in those circumstances. In every circumstance, he knows that. But when his brothers come and they haven't been repentant in the past, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, is what we talked about, and that the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. He needs to know that's what they understand, because fools reject instruction. They don't want knowledge.
Proverbs 1:7.
Yes, in Proverbs 10. So yeah. Both of them, so that's what we were discussing.
Yeah.
So I was so impressed with Joseph, because here he is 27 years later. He's affected not only, obviously, his sons, but he's affected even his household, like a steward.
Yeah.
Recognizing that Joseph, God, is the real God.
That's right.
And so Joseph,
wherever he's been.
So Joseph needs to know that about his brothers now.
Yeah.
Because malice and hatred, jealousy have been in the house all along.
Yeah.
And now you notice when Judah talks, he says, and my father had two sons. They're not even jealous now.
No.
That Jacob had Benjamin and Joseph.
Yeah.
All they're worried about is their father and his concern and what this will do to him now.
That's right.
So they've totally changed. But he had to do that. Joseph had to disguise himself.
Yeah.
In this circumstance, because he had to know that they had actually now turned to God themselves.
That's right. To seek heaven's agenda, it was necessary for him to handle it this way. from the standpoint of his own emotions, which he knew could just, I mean, he's very emotional. He loves his family. He's sorrowful that this has ever, clearly that this has ever happened. He's wired to want to honor God. He's dropped hints of his honoring of God in the comment about the return of the money in the sacks. The teachable thing for us is when we get in a very tense situation, a very clarifying question, and I will admit I don't always ask this question like I should, but I'm recommending it to all of us. What do we want the outcome of that tense situation to be? And does that outcome align with the will of God? It is the power of that question asked up front can make all the difference in how a situation is resolved or if a situation is resolved. Some glimpses of Jesus. We'll just run through these quickly. We have about 5 minutes. Judah's willingness to bear the blame, as has been commented on, is illustrative of the spirit of Jesus Christ, the descendant of Judah. As has been pointed out, Judah has certainly matured. Life has certainly refined him. And he is showing a quality, a godliness about him that is willing to bear the blame. He says, "Let me bear the blame forever." Even Reuben, to some extent, although he was willing to let others, in effect, bear the blame for his failure to deliver Benjamin, namely his two sons, Judah's appeal is much more noble. Of course, as we've noted, Joseph's providing bread for the nations is a foretaste of the coming of Jesus Christ. We see in this text God's strong desire for reconciliation, for unity among brethren. And again, the scripture is filled with passages that emphasize heaven's strong desire for unity among brethren. The need for forgiveness and indeed the power of forgiveness. Notice, let's go to chapter 45 for a second. I just had a thought. Joseph, throughout this, I guess we could add to our list of, you know, what was helpful about Joseph disguising his identity. It gave him time to reflect upon the next step he should take, right? It really did. It bought him a kind of a safe distance to prayerfully figure this out, what should happen next. Joseph has clearly thought a lot about his brothers, and he's been observing, I mean, even as he says something to them at one point, and they begin squabbling amongst themselves, and I told you, and didn't you, you know, and they're just, and of course, the text says they don't know that Joseph understands them. So they're speaking in their native tongue. But he's hearing this. He's very moved by it. But he's also, I think, reflecting on it. Genesis 45 and verse 4. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." And they came closer. And as a reader, we're like, get on with it. We've all been anticipating this. And he said, "I am your brother, Joseph." Before he just screamed out, "I am Joseph." "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves." He knew human beings. He knew these 10 human beings. I mean, Benjamin's there too, but Benjamin didn't sell him. The 10 did. "Don't be grieved or angry because you sold me here." He's not saying it wasn't wrong. He's just saying there's a bigger purpose here. I think that's where he's heading with this. For God sent me before you. Verse 5, verse 7, verse 8, verse 9, God did it. Four times at least. And this isn't the last time he'll speak like that. Chapter 50, he'll speak like that. Because once Jacob dies, now they're really, you know, it'll be like, okay, now he can really lower the boom. And he still won't. Where he really shows the quality of God. But what power of forgiveness to overcome resentment and anger. Joseph's forgiving of them helped these brothers overcome their sin. How do we help someone else overcome their sin? Galatians 6 and verse 1 says, with a spirit of gentleness, with a spirit of humility, looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted. And those are very powerful tools in helping to get someone, as Jacob mentioned Sunday night, to admit, yep, I'm the problem. Yep, I need to change. Yep, I need to prostrate myself before God. Yep, I need to repent. But sometimes we let our grievances and our personality get in the way and just mess everything up. We need to get out of the way and let the Lord work. The importance of acknowledging sin, Brother Kyle, to your point, confession, is a key part of restoration. And along the way, they confessed. They didn't realize they were confessing to Joseph, but they confessed. There's also the language in here about your sin finding you out, which is something Moses would say later to the children of Israel. Demonstration of God's mercy and grace. Again, mercy is when God doesn't give us what we deserve. Grace is when he gives us what we don't deserve. We see both of those in this text. Joseph forgives. He does not punish. And then further grants abundant blessings in the land of Egypt. God uses the sins of men to save, clearly. God is able to bring about new beginnings. And we're seeing the fulfillment of God's promises ongoing. That was the last one. Any final thoughts?